Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast.
So I was introduced to our next guest, Lucy, by Professor Winder of Nottingham Trent University, who found Lucy to be a powerful and compelling speaker. Many of the guests we've had on have been keynote speakers at national and international events, but Lucy stands out as her invite wasn't as a result of her forensic research or treatment expertise, but as a consequence of a path of activism that she embarked on in relation to her own experiences and her need to protect the well-being of her children. In 2015, Lucy's ex-husband and father to her two young children was convicted of downloading indecent images of children. He received a three-year community order plus a five-year sexual harm prevention order and a requirement to sign the sex offenders register. As he's remained part of society throughout the judicial process, Lucy's family had to adapt to living within a set of restrictions, which demonstrated that Lucy was maintaining an adequate protective factor around her children. This has had a profound effect on every area of her life and influenced her parental choices, where they live, her employability, her friendships and relationships. During 2018, a series of events resulted in her decision to approach various authorities and organisations in 2019 to start the discussion around the three safeguarding gaps she perceived her children fell through in the current system. Due to the empathy and openness she found from key people, she was inspired to keep sharing her story. During 2021, Lucy is delivering a series of awareness sessions with frontline and senior police officers from all over the UK. And this year, Lucy was invited to be the keynote speaker at the National Working Group Tackling Child Sexual Exploitation, and in July, she'll be featured within The Guardian. Lucy has a very important and moving story, and we're delighted to welcome her onto the podcast today to share some of her learning with us. So Lucy, really good to have you here today.
Hi Lucy, can you begin by telling us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be speaking up for so many children?
Well, as Naomi said, my world shifted and imploded in 2015, and I found it a very isolating experience with very little support, either through authorities or charities and within my own community. And I began speaking out because the sort of threat, the risk to my anonymity, so because as I said, unfortunately there is quite a lot of negative community judgment, the risk to people knowing became less than the potential benefits that it would bring my children for speaking out. So at that point, so back in 2018, my children didn't know what their dad had done. So because I'd had such a tough time, and I had to go fund my own counselling, quite extensive counselling, to understand what had happened and how it happened and what it meant to me as an individual in my present and future, as well as my past. I kind of feared that my children would be facing the same uphill battle with lack of support. So that was really my driver right from the start to speak out, is the fact that I didn't want my children to face the same struggles that I did.
Thank you. And at the time, what was your experience of the police?
So, very, very limited, actually. So, I did not see this coming at all. I divorced my husband the year before for numerous reasons, but this was not on my radar in any shape or form. He was always very respectful around children. I just never in a million years thought he'd ever do anything like this. So when the police knocked on my door, I hadn't had any contact with police at any point in my life, and I found them to be, I was very lucky, I think. The police that knocked on my door were very kind. The police officer actually said to me, I'm really sorry, but life will never be the same again from this point onwards, and the next few months are going to be hell, and there's nothing you can do to avoid that. And those words will stay with me forever. And I think that really did set the tone for the next 2.5 hours. The police were in my home, they were doing a job, they were taking every single piece of electronic item that we owned, from the children's laptops, my laptops, even though we no longer lived there. They had a really old Wii at the time. This is like pre-PlayStation and Xbox affordability. This is like, you know, 6 years ago now. They had a Wii that went. My new camera, all the CDs containing pictures of the children when they were babies. Absolutely anything that could have saved a picture was taken. And it was overwhelming, really. And then one of the police officers did stop. So my little lads, they were only 6 and 3 at the time, and the eldest was car obsessed. And he did stop at one point and speak to my son. And because he really wanted to know, like, what was the fastest car you'd driven? You know, that was like, oh my God, I'm actually speaking to a police officer. How exciting. So, you know, for me, it was like every inch of my home was being like gone over by police. It was deeply traumatic. And my 6-year-old was like, ooh, police officer, opportunity. And luckily the police officer was kind enough to, you know, talk to him for 5 minutes. And when I was tucking him into bed that night, because this all happened at 7 o'clock in the evening and they left about 9:30, you know, my eldest, he was going to bed saying he didn't want to be a police officer because he was listing out all the cars that the policemen wouldn't be able to keep up with and save if they were stolen. And my youngest was just super excited because he'd watched TV really late on a school night and he thought that was brilliant. So I think from my perspective, that first interaction with the police was really, it was a life-changing moment, but it wasn't dramatic. Unfortunately, there have been a lot of women that I've spoken to since, over the last kind of year and a half, that have had much more deeply traumatic experiences than me. But I didn't perceive that night as a trauma event until I was a participant in Nottingham Trent University's research last year, in which I actually did trauma-based questionnaire, and it actually identified that I had mild PTSD because it was such an unexpected life-changing event that it meant in the months afterwards, if there was a knock on the door, I'd go into fight or flight. You know, what's going to be behind this door now? And I'd be waking up in the middle of the night with my heart pounding and kind of like night terrors that my children were in danger. And that went on for months. So actually, even though I didn't perceive my interaction with the police as being traumatic, it was a trauma. So, And then moving on from that, I spoke to the police officer twice further. The first time was to discuss the level of suicidal tendencies that they thought that my ex-husband was demonstrating. And I agreed that I felt like it was a possibility. So obviously they had measures in place. We were already separated. He couldn't return to the family home. That was part of his bail conditions. And then I spoke to them another time to say, when am I going to get my baby's photos back? And when am I going to get my laptops back? And they said that was unended. And then I was very lucky. So I did speak to them a third time after the investigation, was when it got to magistrate's court. And the lead officer said he couldn't tell me anything at all. In that second phone call, he said he couldn't tell me anything at all until it was available in the public arena. So I didn't know what type of images he was looking at, how long it was going on for, anything, until it went to magistrate's court. And I felt unable to attend court that day through fear of media exposure. Because I thought, you know, what if they take a picture of me on the, you know, read the local newspaper and there's all these, like, you know, tabloid photos. And I thought, what if they took a picture of me coming down the steps, a supportive ex-wife? And also I didn't want the humiliation of hearing the charges for the first time and people watching my reaction. So this officer was kind enough to say, you know, phone me after the date and I'll go through everything with you. And I was devastated because it transpired that it was dated back to whilst I was pregnant with my youngest child until the day he moved out. So I didn't expect it to be going on for that long. And unfortunately, it was across all three categories, which means that it did include the most extreme imagery. And I wasn't expecting that either. my ex-husband gave me the impression that it was, they'd find maybe 20 images. And I don't know whether he said or whether I filled in the gaps, that because he said he stumbled across them. So I thought they may be barely illegal teens. To find out that the children were as young as five was just, it made me feel so sick. And then I didn't go to Crown Court. And this is where I think the police could seriously improve their processes, because nobody contacted me after Crown Court. Nobody explained to me the full extent of the charges that he pleaded guilty to and what the sexual harm prevention order actually meant to us as a family. And I didn't get to hear the judge's comments. So I think the police, they imploded my world. They came and told me this is what my ex-husband was capable of. I really think they should see the process through, and part of standard police safeguarding processes and duty of care to my children, they should come back into the family after the sentence has been decided and face to face tell us what happened. You know, one phone call with my children playing in the other room and me sitting in the dining room table, and you're hitting me with these over 1,000 images across all three categories going on for 4 years. It was just awful. So I think the police, they, in my particular case, they were okay, but they were just following standard operating procedures, and I don't think they're good enough.
Can I just clarify something? Because I mean, what I hear you describing is a shocking event, which obviously transformed your life and the life of your children, and brought with it a number of tremendous potential pitfalls and difficulties. And along the way, you mentioned, I think it was three safeguarding breaks. Mm-hmm. Was that the term you use? What did you mean by that?
So
precisely,
where I perceive the safeguarding gaps are, is firstly during the investigation stage. So I did not see this coming at all. And so when the police knocked on the door, it basically imploded my world. I never in a million years thought he was capable of looking at indecent images. It was a complete shock. And once myself and my children were assessed by Children's Services, which was 4 days after police knocked on the door, I was deemed a suitable protective factor. I signed a 100% supervision only contact agreement, and that was the last I have heard from Children's Services ever. No one in 6 years has ever independently spoken to my children about their ongoing relationship with their dad. It, as far as Children's Services, I ticked boxes and their involvement with my family ended. Likewise with the police, I saw them on the day of the knock, obviously, because they came and with a search warrant and searched my house, and they were in the house for 2.5 hours. And then I spoke to a police officer twice. The first time was to discuss the level of suicide risk that my ex-husband was presenting. And then the second one was just, well, I was asking when I was going to get my laptop back. And they said they didn't know. And he also said he could give me absolutely no further information because I was the ex-wife, so, you know, it would be a breach of confidentiality. However, he did say, if I contacted him after Magistrates Court, when the information was within the public domain, he would share that information with me. So I only spoke to the police three times at all. So I think that complete lack of authority contact throughout the investigation stage, which has no definable time limit, so it really depends on which area of the country you're in to see how much the digital forensics can work. So for me, I was very, very lucky. It was only 5 months. There's ladies on the forum that report up to 3 years. And when you've got children, that means you don't know whether daddy's going to be able to come back and live at home again. You don't know if there's any the charges will come to anything, whether it's just an investigation. Daddy has to live away from home the whole time because there is a low risk, because it's an identified, he's got predilection to underage subjects, albeit online, but until the investigation is completed, you have to approach that individual as having some level of risk. So, you know, unsupervised access is advised by Children's Services. So that's that limbo stage. You've got no contact with anybody. And it's I think these things that I reflect back on and think, if I'd have, you know, thought about a scenario in which, on reflection, now I had this missing piece of the puzzle, you know, was that, did something happen? Like, you know, I mean, my ex-husband didn't actually bath the children at all, but if he had have helped out, I can imagine, you know, some women just be distraught at the thought that he might have actually taken indecent images and things like that. And who would I talk to about that? Because I had no contact with anybody in authority. So I'm hearing a lot in the news at the moment about, you know, children not disclosing childhood abuse, either direct or in the photographic evidence and things like that later on. And they reflect back and then they remember it and then they disclose. But we need a mechanism of children disclosing near at the time. And certainly if my children disclose something to me, you know, I remember daddy doing something and it was weird, I wouldn't have anybody to have turned to discuss that with. So I think there's that angle as well. I mean, granted, most indecent images offenders are online only, they're not contact abusers, but if no one's staying in contact with these children, how do we know? So when I started making phone calls to the police, what I was shocked about was we can't define their numbers now because the police only record the number of children safeguarded. They do not record the number of children present at the address. So the police record, like, so if it's a teacher, for instance, there could be 200 children safeguarded by an arrest because obviously they've made sure that those children are safe from that individual. If that teacher had children themselves, those two would not be any different to the overall safeguarding number. So I think it's kind of, yeah, that, to me, that's a safeguarding gap, because if we can't define the problem, we can't solve the problem. So, yeah, we can't quantify it. And that leads on to the second one, which I think is court. I think it's absolutely heartbreaking when you read about you know, an offender, father of two, and they give his full name, the street name, and the town that he lives. Those children have to go to school the next day in that town, and they face potential bullying by people knowing. And you know, mothers like me who might have tried really, really hard not to tell anybody throughout the whole investigation stage, and people wondering why, you know, dad moved out and you've had to make up an excuse and, you know, almost lying about your own life, you know, that kind of scenario. And you've been doing all that for months and months and months, and all that hard work, the moment it goes to media, suddenly your family is exposed to the negative community judgment that you've tried so hard to prevent them having. And that is the reason why I didn't go to court. So I didn't go to court to hear the charges myself, because I feared that, I was told he was going to go to prison. By the police and Children's Services, I was told he was going to go to prison. So even after magistrates, the police officer, when he told me the charges that he were being brought against him that he pleaded guilty for, you know, he felt at that point he was going to go to prison. And I was in shock then, because I'd just spent 5 months believing that there were maybe 20 images of barely illegal teens. And it wasn't. It was across all three categories. And it was over 1,000 over 4 years. So it was massive. I thought it was just going to be, you know, in the previous year is what he indicated to me. And it wasn't. It was over a lot longer and a lot higher and a lot worse. So I thought, imagine going to court and hearing the judge's comments about him. I just couldn't face it. I couldn't face people looking at the ex-wife and, you know, watching me fall apart, basically. And if he'd gone to prison, who would the media take a photo of? Because he'd be going to prison, so they'd take the supportive ex-wife walking down the steps. But because I didn't go to prison, nobody has ever talked through what's in his SHPO with me. Yet, so sorry, sexual harm prevention order. So in 2018, he wanted his new girlfriend to supervise the children, and I said no. And then it was a series of things. I approached children's services. Things got very serious very fast, because they thought I was indicating that I was going to support the ex-girlfriend doing the supervising, and then therefore they questioned my parental judgment. And I was like, no, I'm saying I don't want her to do it. He's saying his probation officer has told him he can. It's got all really messy. And then I spoke to a lawyer, and the lawyer said to me, a judge could view me negatively because I hadn't found out what was in the SHPO. So it was like my parental responsibility were to find out what the children's father had done in order for me to adequately protect the children. So it was all on me to have found out what that was. And that's why I think that safeguarding gap around court comes in, because somebody should have sat me down and made sure that I understood what the father of my children had done so that I could adequately protect them. Because at that point, I knew he didn't go to prison. And I knew that, you know, he told me what the child, you know, what his sentence was. I still don't know what he did as part of his community order, but I know he had one. But because of the emphasis that police placed on confidentiality all the way through the investigation stage, I didn't know I was allowed to ask for that level of detail. So I felt very let down. And I think that's wrong. And then the third gap is, you know, it's very difficult managing your children long term with supervised access only with their dad. I have only recently disclosed to my children what their dad has done, but I couldn't get any support with that. My concern was if I got it wrong, would they search online to find out what their dad had done and therefore become perpetrators themselves by seeing the photos? You know, would they question whether or not they've got the same predilection as him because he's their dad? And I just didn't know how they respond or what age to tell them or anything. And there was no support for me. And additionally, he's now completed everything. He is free in society and off the sex offenders register. So he wants now to see his children unsupervised. We've worked the process through with lawyers and children's services. And unless we go to court, the advice is that we continue with unsupervised access. And if I'd have supported unsupervised access as soon as he became free from restrictions, my parenting judgment would once again be brought into question because I knew of his historic crime. So my feeling with my ex is he wouldn't offend, contact offence. My concern is he would re-offend online because he's stupid. but I don't think he'd ever harm our children. So I would be prepared to do unsupervised daytime only, absolutely no for weekend, you know, no overnight or anything. But, you know, he can have a proper father-child relationship and take them on day trips and stuff. But I was told, we worked it through, and I was told if I'd have allowed that, I would have been judged. But nobody told me that these unsupervised contact was supposed to be lifelong. So that, I feel, is another safeguarding gap. You know, families need support during the investigation. They need empathy and support during court so that they can fully understand what's going on. And we need support long term as well. So, yeah.
Thank you. That's really helpful and very powerful description. I mean, you've given a truly Kafkaesque description of a situation that clearly obtains for people in your situation. The other image that came to mind whilst you were talking was of being in a fog with a blindfold on. It does sound enormously difficult.
Yeah, it sounds like it's left very much to chance as to what information you get. But I wondered also, Lucy, whether some people might find the police coming to their door with a different kind of attitude. It sounds like you had a good experience of kind police, but my guess is there would be times when police might be quite judgmental about you and the family.
Yeah, I think that there have been some women. I've had the opportunity to speak to a lot of women now that have gone through what I've been through, and also being an active participant in peer-to-peer online forums. And what I felt, and what all women feel, is we are a tick box exercise. It's very much about processing of the offender. They are the police are there to do a job. I do think that most police officers are mindful of what they're doing. So most of the time they go into homes and they're going in to help in this particular circumstance. Certainly from the officers that I've had the opportunity to speak to, they're very mindful of the fact that they're going in and going to be leaving a mess behind, effectively. And as the officer that came to the door to me said, you know, they are, life will never be the same again. And I think they're very aware of that. I think where it can be done a little bit, there are some ladies that I know that have had multiple police officers in their house, children distressed, mum distressed, and they're just ill-equipped to deal with it. And most of the time the police do know who in the household is likely to have accessed the images. I think families where there's a question mark on who is the perpetrator feel a lot more judgment. So if it's clear, like in my case, that it was my ex-husband, because obviously, well, I don't watch porn at all. So it must have been our IP address must have had a pattern of a pattern up until the day he moved out, and then it changed and obviously went to his new IP address. So it was very clear in my case who the perpetrator was. I think when there's a home with, either a same-sex couple or teenage children might be the perpetrators, or the father, or even the mother. You know, let's be honest, it mainly is men, but it's not always men. So I think if there's a question mark on who the perpetrator is, that does dictate the police's attitude when they do that knock on the door. So yeah, it's mm-hmm. The majority of the time I think the police are aware of the trauma. Not necessarily labelling it a trauma, but they're aware of the upset that the news they're bringing to the door is going to bring. So, yeah.
But it's strange, isn't it? Because we often hear on the news, particularly the news, about the police sending in support officers to help families, the families of victims. But it seems that in this situation, you weren't regarded as a victim in the same way.
No, unfortunately we're not, and neither are my children. So for a long time I held the position that thank God we didn't need a victim support officer, because my children weren't harmed by my ex-husband, directly harmed. There was no sign of historic direct abuse. The police didn't suspect that. Children's services met my children once, you know, assessed us and said there's no sign of historic abuse, and they completely stepped back. And as I said, unfortunately, and as you picked up on, there was no police support officer, because we are not covered under the Victims Code. So family members are not included in the Victims Code. So we are secondary victims in the current legal definition. We fall under secondary victims, which means that we don't get the same support and safety net. My children will get the same safety net that a child would who'd been directly abused. I believe strongly that actually my children can appreciate women and mothers and extended family members also feel as victimised as I do, being a close associate of a sex offender. But I think my children fit that definition of Victims Code, and thus should actually have a victim support officer from day one, because of the ramifications for them, not only during the investigation stage and during the community-based sentencing. It shapes their childhood, and the ramifications last a lifetime. And I think that because of that, the economic, social, and psychological and emotional impact on my children is so significant that they should get that definition, but currently they don't. So as I said, at the moment, police officers and children's services are going on current protocols of dealing with family members that aren't victims, and we're not victims. So we're very much a tick box exercise.
And yet, Lucy, I mean, you referred to it as a trauma, and I suppose what we know about trauma is it's not so much the actual incident, but it's whether that disconnects you from other people and whether it's acknowledged in some way. And of course, there's something very isolating about the circumstances that you're describing. And so for it not to be acknowledged as a harm, you know, in some ways is what then helps that stick as a trauma, whereas actually if there was support available, you were seen as being a victim, it might have been very different in terms of the impact on you thereafter.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think the complete lack of response from all authorities compounded the victimisation that I've felt by the negative community judgment that I've experienced. As I said, this tick box exercise, the police weren't concerned, they couldn't assign me. They did say if my property was spray painted or my car scratched or there was a verbal confrontation that had been witnessed, then I would be considered a victim in my own right, and then I could be referred through to the multi-agency support hub, but it wouldn't be for the original crime that my family sort of became involved with or was affected by. It would be because now I was a victim in my own right. So I think the police could have really helped me get the recognition that of what kind of validation of my experience, I suppose. And because they didn't stay in contact with us at all, and children's services likewise, they, you know, we ticked the boxes. I signed 100% supervised only access agreement, which verbally I was told was to last until they were adults, but on paper it just said until the police complete their investigation. I ticked the boxes. My children were never considered at risk. I was not assigned a social worker, and then that was it. So within 2 weeks, I'd had this knock on the door, my world imploded completely. Police didn't feel me worthy of staying in contact because I'm not damaged enough. I'm not victimised enough. Children's services say, you know, well, you're showing good enough protective factor. You know, we've got another child to kind of, we need to go and look after another child. Your children are safe, which you're grateful for at the time. And I mean, I was relieved really that children's services weren't involved in my life. But then there was nothing. I tried reaching out to charities. And because of this reliance on the victims code, there was no funding. So I approached victim support. I feel like a victim because I've been warned about my children being excluded from play dates and class parties if it were to get out. I've been warned that if it was to be known in the community, I could have vigilante behaviour directed towards me because they knew that he once lived with me. I was allowing my children to carry on seeing him supervised because I felt, well, they would have been devastated not seeing their dad, and I couldn't give them an explanation why. So until I knew what I was dealing with, I felt it was appropriate to allow them to carry on seeing him supervised by myself during the investigation stage, and my in-laws ever since he was found guilty and not gone to prison. But that judgment that I felt for allowing that contact to continue has been very difficult. So not having that recognition that what I went through as an individual was traumatic has meant that this situation keeps getting on top of me. I feel like I'm on a loop. I'm building up and then getting knocked back down because there's no one helping me to kind of move forward out of this. It means that I'm stuck.
It sounds really, really difficult, Lucy, and I imagine just, you know, thinking about that decision about how much contact to allow the children to have with their father must have been really, really complex. How did, you know, what support did you have for making that decision? How did you?
Well, the only support I've had actually has been the support that I've paid for, basically. So for me, it was when he was first arrested, the children, for bail conditions meant he couldn't see the children at all until they'd been assessed by children's services. As I said, the process was quite quick for us, which was lucky. probably because we were already divorced, to be honest. So when they said to me supervised access only, I said yes, signed the paperwork, and that was kind of like brilliant, you know, tick box, away you go. And that paperwork said he could see them twice a week for an hour supervised by me in my then family home. I struggled, but as I said, I felt my ex-husband was suicidal, and what I was desperate for was that my part of my children's backstory was not that their dad had committed suicide. I didn't want that for them. So to begin with, it was just damage limitation that for me, that they continued to see him in some form. And I could just, because he'd only moved out 8 months before, they were just adjusting to us being divorced, and they were seeing him daily at that point, but they knew daddy had a new job. So I just said, daddy's working away, so he can't see you very often. So for them, it was a kind of gradual thing. And then after 3 weeks, I made a decision that I wanted to move out of my hometown. 4 weeks after the knock, I put my house on the market. And 3 months after the knock, I'd moved to a new town. So it happened in May. By August, I was no longer living in the town I'd lived my entire life. I was living somewhere else where I knew no one. So for my children, all I kept thinking was, they've gone from seeing their dad living with them to their dad seeing them like once a day to seeing them once or twice a week. I don't want them to associate that moving to our new house with losing their dad. So it was kind of like, just keep going. I was on a rabbit, I was on like a hamster wheel, I suppose. Just hoping hopefully they'll find out what charges he's facing. And that didn't happen until the October. Now, believe it or not, even though that felt, living in limbo for eternity for me, 5 months is quick. So these days, because of the backlog in computer forensic, and a family like mine would actually be facing that limbo stage being about 12 months to 2 years, which is a really long time to know whether or not the man that you loved, made a family with, is capable of a crime like this. And because there's no evidence, it's very, very difficult. So with all that pressure on myself, I just thought, I've just got to keep some sort of consistency for my children. So I allowed him to carry on seeing them. And then when he didn't go to prison, I thought, well, they're not going to see him at all for months. So if I can stay strong and do the supervising right up until that point, that's kind of enough of a buffer, I suppose, to get us to the point that he's going to prison. And then he didn't go to prison. And that broke me at that point. At that point, I went to 9 months of self-funding counselling, because I was like, I didn't expect him not to go to prison. I'd found out in the October, so he went to Crown in the November, but in the October I found out what he'd done. It had been going on for 4 years. I believed he deserved prison. And the police officer thought he was going to go to prison. So to hear that he was going to remain part of society, I didn't really know what to do with that. Unfortunately, I had told hardly anybody, but I told two really good friends. One lady stood by me through it all. She's absolutely awesome. She's like, she restores my faith in human nature every time I see her. Sorry, yesterday actually. She's amazing. But unfortunately, my other friend, after I initially told her, it was like 4 weeks after, I went and told her, look, I'm going to be putting the house on the market. I've decided I need to move out of my, our hometown. I'm going to live away. And she went, are you going to carry on letting him see him then? And I said, well, I don't know whether he's guilty yet or not. So I'm just doing, one thing at a time. And she said, well, if you decide to carry on letting your boys see their dad, I don't think we can stay friends. I don't want to stay contact. I think you're morally wrong for allowing them to do that. Now, that was before he'd even been convicted. So I had a really big, painful lesson very, very early on about the level of community judgment that I will feel for allowing my children to carry on seeing their dad. So I had to, with no support from anyone, so I reached back out to Children's Services, asked them, I can't cope with supervising anymore. Can the mother-in-law do it? Can you go and check her, do whatever authority that's needed? And they said no, because my children don't need a social worker, because they're not considered at risk. So the only way that would happen is if I made a statement that they were at risk, which I wasn't prepared to do because as far as I was concerned, they weren't. And she, the social worker told me that if I were to entrust my children into my ex-mother-in-law's care and she were to allow the children to see their dad without anybody present, then it would, my parental judgment would be brought into question because I trusted the mother-in-law to look after them in the way that I said. So at that point I felt completely unsupported by children's services because I was like, so either I say my children are at risk and then you'll help me make a decision about whether the mother-in-law is the right person to be supervising, or, you know, where do I go? So I went into counselling, so because I had to work it through for myself.
That's such a weighty decision, and just thinking about the fact that you're bright and articulate and resourceful enough and not anti the idea of therapy, whereas for a lot of people, you know, they might not be able to afford counselling or therapy for starters, but also it might not come easily to venture into a relationship of that sort. But just it's quite overwhelming to think about everything you had to take on board, and also the courage and selflessness, because I think that, you know, someone in our orbit who's done something horrendous, so our natural inclination is to want to pull away from them, and yet you were thinking about, well, what was in the best interest of your children. And we know that kids actually do need to understand their history, don't they, and their family relationships, and it's hard to do that if somebody's just excluded from their social world. So there's a real bravery about the decision. And yeah, I'm sure you'd have preferred to have just been able to eliminate him from your social orbit at that point in time.
I think one of the things, and I don't know why, you know, when you just kind of think, where did that thought come from? But it was very strong right from the start, is the fact that he'd done a monstrous thing, potentially. As I said, I didn't have any evidence for a long time. He did say that they might find some images that he'd stumbled across. And as I said, I thought they were barely legal teens, which is wrong, because the children are young. But I thought, 16, 17, stupid, you shouldn't have looked at those. But to look at children as young as 5, that's monstrous. I didn't want my children growing up thinking they were half monster, because they had half his DNA. Because even though I'll never, ever trust him again, and I've got no respect for him as a man, he is going to be their father. And I didn't see it in him, so they need to get to know. It's a really painful early life lesson for them, I suppose, is, you know, you could know somebody, but you'll, you know, people aren't always what they seem. So I kind of thought, I don't want my children to think they're half monster. They've got to know him for themselves. And I'd also done some reading years ago about the impact of being an adopted child and being told that, you know, parents didn't want you, or, you know, oh, your dad was a druggie, that's why they couldn't look after you. And I thought, they need, and how damaging that is to an individual to grow up believing that their parents are this horrible, bad person. So I think that's, and certainly when I worked it through with counselling, that's what we explored a lot, was how important was that core belief that the children need to know their father was to me. And in the end, it was a decision that I just thought, I know they're safe. I know Nanny will look after them and will not leave them in his care alone. So it dropped to like once a fortnight for 4 hours. They've seen him consistently for the last 5 years, so they know him for themselves. And I do stand by that decision, even though I'm still judged by it and I've lost friends over it. Not as dramatically as that first one, mind. I mean, she went in for juggler, really. But I have, unfortunately, lost friends and relationships because they, you know, they don't agree with my decision to allow my children to carry on seeing them. So.
But it's back to that notion of, you know, the impact of a traumatic event, leaving the trauma on us, is, you know, arises when people can't discuss it or acknowledge it or process it. And I guess if, you know, if the children had been prevented from having contact with their dad, that's the situation they would have been in. So no matter how awful it is to, and life-changing to have to be dealing with this from an early age, actually at least you are offering them a space to be able to talk about their relationship with their dad and help them make sense with that as time goes on. But again, I suppose that just makes me think how hard it would be to do that in the absence of support, because that isn't the kind of thing that most parents are expecting to have to encounter. Yeah. Is it?
And I think the other aspect of that with regards to trauma for the child. So my boys were only 3 and 6 when it happened. So as I mentioned previously, to start off with, I could use the excuse daddy's working a lot. And then somewhere along the line, it kind of morphed into, I'm really sorry, kids. This is just the way it's got to be. Or why does Nanny always have to be there? Because sometimes Nanny was on holiday or Nanny wasn't well, and so they had to miss their contact with him. I'm really sorry, kids. It's just the way it's got to be. And so they know something big has happened in their past, but can't quantify it. So they know something's happened, but they don't know what. So we've got this thing in our house that when you say promise, promise, that's like, that's bigger than a promise. That's like a, you know, it will happen. So I always said to them, I promise, promise, my lovelies, when you're old enough, I will tell you why. But for now, this is just the way it's got to be. And they accepted that. But I think that's something else that families really need support with, is around disclosure and when to tell their children. I, in my head, wasn't going to tell my boys until they were teenagers, because I thought they needed to understand about sex, consent, what pornography was, and therefore what an indecent image was. And then through the work that I've been doing, I found an amazing charity in Oxfordshire called Children Heard and Seen. And they were kind enough to give me 2 sessions over the phone, or Zoom, kind of like autumn of last year. And they actually advised that it would have been better that my children were told from the start an age-appropriate version of what was going on. So as they process it, as they grow up, they can ask questions and evolve it for themselves. So picking up really on what you were saying about trauma and recognition of that trauma, you know, they should have had, it would have been better for them. Not they should have, to read all it carefully, but it would have been better for them to have had some form of understanding on why their world had changed so much, and why we are not like any other divorced family. So I made the decision to tell them this Christmas. I was planning to tell them this spring, but then because my ex came off the register and came off his sexual harm prevention order, he now wants unsupervised access, so things sped up a little bit. But I told them, and it went a lot better than I anticipated. It was far worse for me than them. They took it in their strides, as children surprise you every day, don't they? They have not been as upset as I thought they would. So I was expecting quite a lot of emotions from them. They were both upset, but not it wasn't as deep-seated as I was expecting. I did get a lot of anger from my younger one for not telling me the truth. We've had quite a few incidents since where he said to me, are you telling me the truth now, or are you telling me an age-appropriate version of it? So he gets a bit cheeky. But he's quite angry. He's angry with me for not telling him the truth. But I think they know a lot more about sex than I ever thought my children would at 9 and 12. Mainly thanks to a next door neighbour who educated them this summer in a way that I didn't want my children to know. 12-year-olds, that's what happens, isn't it? I think disclosure is another thing around children that I think there needs to be a lot more support for mothers. If I'd have received better support earlier, I would have disclosed earlier, and I think it would have been better for them, especially my youngest, who's had significant separation anxiety over the years around me. And since this year, in 2021, he's just become a less anxious child. And I do believe it's because he now knows what this big thing in his past is. It's no longer the scary thing that they know they're facing, because I promised I'd tell them one day. Well, that day's happened for them now, and it wasn't as scary as they thought it was going to be. So, yeah.
Thank you.
So, I mean, much of this, Lucy, arises from your ex-husband's use of the internet. And of course, for all of us, the internet is a kind of relatively modern phenomenon. I'm not a great expert on this, but I understand that pornography is the biggest industry on the internet. So both the accessibility and, of course, the monitoring and therefore the kind of capturing of the perpetrators, like your husband, yeah, is a modern day phenomenon. What's your view on the internet?
Well, I think this is when the statistics come into this. So, you know, you're talking about how it's evolved. So when my ex-husband was convicted in 2015, I don't know the exact figure, I really should find that out, but it was around 540 convictions for indecent images offences in 2015. The truly scary figures now are the police are arresting 850 per month. So that's 10,000 in the last year that have been arrested for this crime. So the exponential identification of perpetrators is skyrocketing because the police are getting better at their job. The technology is enhanced. They're able to tag photos now and find out everywhere they've gone. Obviously, COVID had a massive impact because everybody's been at home, and therefore the opportunity for private time at home has increased. So it's gonna, you know, the exponential rise is set to continue, really, especially when the backlog in identification of perpetrators is going to be worked through, and they're getting better at that all the time because the technology for police is getting better at tracking things. So it is massive. You know, I mean, I can still remember us having our first mobile phones and then our first smartphones. We were married, you know, it's like within like, you know, this has all happened within the last 20 years. I can remember us both sitting down discussing whether we were going to get broadband at home because we can access the internet and work, so there's no point. And then we did get broadband at home because they put super fast broadband in our area and we were able to afford it. You know, suddenly it was affordability with like the main companies. And so, yeah, we had internet at home. So I think if he wasn't able to access it, you know, the accessibility of the internet, it's, you know, he was able to explore pornography. I mean, I was told that the reason why he wasn't sent to prison was there was no videos and also no evidence that he went specifically searching for images. But I find that really hard to understand because I was like, you've got over 1,000 images over 4 years, so you must have gone searching for them. But he must have, I don't know who to ask this question to, but the only logical conclusion I've come to is he must frequent sites that when you download a cache of images, I don't really know how it works, but I know that you can download 20 images and 19 of them will be, you know, just sort of legal porn, and then there'll be, you know, an indecent image in there as well, or, you know, barely illegal teens, but they claim they're all over 18, but actually you're downloading a shed load of images that are clearly under 18. So it's a very murky area, and I think it used to be you had to be quite clever to find indecent images online, but now there's a piece of research that's out that says, you know, an indecent image is just 3 clicks away. And that's really, truly scary as a parent, you know, because you think my sons could go online and then, you know, 3 clicks away, and that's not, that you don't have to be on the dark web to find these images. They are out there. So I think the accessibility of the internet has an awful lot to answer for, and the ease of access into legal pornography means that, you know, there's a thought process amongst some of the forums that men fall down like a porn rabbit hole, so they become desensitized and are, you know, their online and offline demarcation becomes so marked, and they've watched so much porn that they become desensitized to the images they see, so they just kind of go more and more and more extreme. And the ease that the internet allows them to do that is actually to blame for behavior, not for them. So I disagree with that. I think, well, you know, if I ever saw an image like that, I would never ever go on that website ever again. But I'm somebody who doesn't watch porn at all, so that's quite a hard, and I never have. So it's quite hard. I don't really understand that world. But the porn rabbit hole is definitely something that's talked about a lot on these forums. you know, my husband was depressed, he was drinking more, or, you know, staying up late, struggling with stress, you know, trying to have escapism in porn. And then it becomes like a self-fulfilling kind of unhealthy response to stress.
It certainly sounds like something which needs much more open debate and discussion, really, and it's difficult to get that in our current political climate, I think, where things get shut down so quickly.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, hopefully this online sex harm bill, I think that's the right words, but I know there's a bill going through at the moment, you know, and hopefully that will help a little bit. But I think it's educating people. Certainly, my ex-husband believed that he'd complete his sentence and then it would be business as usual, as in, well, I've done my sentence, I can now see my children and supervise. That's not the case. I think the ramifications for looking at indecent images should be much more widely known. So he's lost the ability, and my children have lost the autonomy within their relationship with their dad, because they want to see more of their dad. But if I allow that, even though he's no longer on the register, my parenting judgment would be brought into question. So they'd be put on the at-risk register. So it's like, it is lifelong. They will never be able to see him unsupervised. A judge might make a different decision. We'll find out. He's taking me to court this year. So we'll see what the judge says. But I very much doubt it. All the legal advice that I've received says no. You know, this is the way it's got to be now. So I think the consequences need to be much clearer for people. And that will deter him. That's the biggest deterrent, I think.
It's outpaced the evolution of the human being.
Yes, yes. Yeah, yeah, we just don't know. We've got all this power at our fingertips. And unfortunately, it has meant that, you know, these thoughts that might never have been fully explored can now at 3 a.m. in the morning be click, click, click.
The thing that still resonates with me is your use of the term the knock. And of course, there was a film called The Knock once, I think, which was about a totally different subject. But the use of the term signifies to me that was a totally life-changing and significant moment. Yeah, in the life of you and the rest of your family.
Yeah, no, the knock. It is like the knock on the door that changed everything. And it's really like, I've described it as, when I'm doing some police talks at the moment, to kind of emphasise how significant that knock is. It's like the police handing me a pair of glasses. So with these pair of glasses, I look back to my past and suddenly everything's seen from a different perspective. So life events that I thought were down to him being, you know, a rubbish husband and a lazy father, I now look at them and think, you know, were you acting like that for a different reason? For instance, he never ever helped with bath time. He didn't come to children's parties with us. He rarely came up the park even. Never went swimming with us. Why? Now, was it because I was right and he was just lazy? Or was it because he was some way protecting his children and me for the inappropriate thoughts he was beginning to form? And whether or not it was the online, offline demarcation, and actually, you know, my reasons for divorcing were valid. Or with these glasses now, do I look back and think, well, no, you know, there was another reason behind your behaviour that I didn't know about at the time. And I think those glasses, what that means to the present is, you know, suddenly my safe space, my home, my family home, there was an abhorrent crime committed whilst I was living there with my children sleeping upstairs, and I didn't see it and I didn't know it. And how did I miss it? And the shame of missing it, and the fear these glasses give you, that, you know, the father of your children could actually be a danger to them, which is against all the core beliefs you hold, like I held, about what it meant to be a father and what it meant to be a husband. So, and the glasses then, when you look to the future, there's dangers within your community. You're in danger of being judged. And I was quite a snob back then, so I lived in a very nice part of town and my children attended a faith school, and I was like, I'm going to be receiving judgment at the school gate for something that I had no knowledge of, and are they going to be asking the question, you know, how did she not know? Has she got the same interest too? It's that kind of fear that you're going to, the blackness that child sexual abuse is spread to you. So those glasses mean that the future that you thought you were going to have in, and the life that you were going to have and the opportunities suddenly don't look certain, and there's dangers in the road ahead that you never saw. And that's what the knock means. In that instant, you're handed these pair of glasses and everything means something different. And we all, you know, on the forums and things talk about the impact of the knock being so life-changing. But I think there's quite a lot of women who don't want to wear those glasses anymore, even though you're being told you have to put them on, this is your reality now. They reject them completely and say, you've got the wrong person, you know, these aren't for me, this is not, he hasn't done that, no way, I don't like, with these glasses, I don't like what it meant, my past means now, I don't like that, and the future's too scary and this is overwhelming, I don't want it. And you can reject quite strongly that what you're being told at the knock is true, because it's just too much. So yeah, the knock, it is a life-changing incident, a bit like being run over by a car. Once it's done, it's, you know, the injuries you carry from that, you have to carry forward. So yeah, it's tough.
But I think, Lucy, that, you know, it's been fantastic interviewing you, because I think actually from many people could have just shied away from, you know, buried their head in a hole and really tried to stay as far away from this subject as possible. I really admire the fact that you've decided to actually become more, go down the route of being more of an activist and actually really trying to campaign and change things for the better so that people don't have the same experience that you had in the future, you know, that there is more available for them. And I think, you know, that can't have been an easy path to choose to go down, because it would be, I'm sure it'd be so much more easier to just not have to think about any of this sort of stuff. And the fact that you are tirelessly out campaigning and telling a very personal story, which is more draining than talking about something that's not related to you. So yeah, you know, hats off to you for doing such amazing work.
You say that though, but it was desperation. I couldn't, living the life I was living was breaking me. Because I kept going down this rebuilding and rebuilding and rebuilding, and I thought, I can't carry on like this. I've tried counselling, I've got no support. So doing nothing became not an option for me anymore. And the only way of getting more support for myself and my children was to start speaking out. And actually being able to freely talk to people like you who don't know, really know me, means that I can actually own my past, whereas I was finding that I was, it is like living in witness protection without any support, because I couldn't talk about this great big part of my past and everything was being so heavily filtered. It was psychologically really difficult to live with, and actually being able to speak about it to professionals. And okay, I'm still hiding, because I'm still hiding behind not anonymity most of the time. For instance, when I go to The Guardian, I'm not going to be me. I'm going to be a different name. It means that I can actually be authentic. And having that authenticity taken away from me was very, very difficult. And no, I don't want to, like, hard, you know, I'm sure more people in my local community know than I think know. But I don't talk about this to people in my daily life, and I am very isolated. And I think if people knew what I'd gone through, I'd probably have more friends, because, you know, some of them would judge, but some of them might not. And I think that feeling of being suppressed and not being able to say was actually far more damaging. And so it did. I would love to have just been able to pretend it didn't happen and carry on living life as if, you know, not talking about it, quite frankly. But not talking about it was damaging me far more than being, you know, doing what I'm doing. So it, speaking out became part of my survival, kind of like trying to thrive and not just survive, that kind of thing. And, you know, good old J.K. Rowling with her, you know, the foundation. That's it. Rock bottom became the strong foundation for which everything I have is now built upon. I think that's the kind of like, yeah, you know, you get to rock bottom and you have to do something different. So, yeah, thank you. Doesn't feel brave, it just feels like necessity.
Yeah, but I think you know you're a great advocate for actually how facing into something that's overwhelming and frightening actually can give you more of a sense of mastery over it. Thank you very much. You know, people say you create your own luck, don't they? And so I think there's something about your own ability to make decisions about making the most out of a situation, but I can also hear you're really passionate about changing things for the better for all these other children. And you know, could you summarize the practical things that you think could be done to make a real difference to the families of those who are convicted of these kind of offences?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first safeguarding gap, I mean, you know, if the children could be identified, so the cases where children are present in family home where the search warrant is carried out, we need to know their numbers so that somebody, I don't know whether it's police or children's services, someone needs to take responsibility to go back in and check in with that family. So for my children, started really struggling with the change in pattern of interaction with their dad after about 3 months. I then moved them, you know, we moved house and we moved location after 4 months. But, you know, I think somebody needs to be checking in and seeing whether any further interventions are needed for the family. So maybe at 3 months, children's services go back in and see how the family is coping with the enforced supervised access only. Because obviously we can't tell anybody what's going on. Then our normal community support networks are shut off to us. So that's really tough. I think at court, I think children like mine should have the same protection that direct victims have, and the case is not reported in the media, because having that pressure off their mum all the way through the investigation stage to say, whatever you try to do, you know, if you want to keep this on the lowdown, you can do it, because it's not going to all be blown apart when it hits the media. You know, if it hit the media, my children would never be able to control disclosure amongst their peers, because finding out about their parents' crime is a Google search away until, well, forever. So I think it's, you know, that. So media, and somebody to tell the remaining safeguarding adults what the results of the court process has been, be it no further action or the sentence, and explain what that means. And I think it's really important that once they come off the sex offenders register, that once again that remaining safeguarding adult is contacted and have it explained to them that he may be free, or she, I know that it's mainly men, but he may be free to spend time with children in society, but he's not free to spend time with yours unless you do the right thing. And the right thing is to go through children's services and have an agreed safety plan, go through child protection conference, and basically any contact will need to be done in a public place only, or you go to court and a judge deems it within that child's best interest for there to be unsupervised access. Because I think at the moment, women like me, you know, if you don't ask, you just assume, well, look, he's free, therefore, yeah, I'm not, they're fine, they can see their dad again. But actually, if anything were to happen again in the future and it could be found out, then I'd be judged. So I think that's, communication has to be improved between authorities and the remaining safeguarding adult, and there needs to be more checking in. We shouldn't be allowed to, you know, make it up as we go along, absolutely. So yeah, practical things are, contact, communication, fairness.
And they sound quite simple things, you know, they don't sound like huge, really complicated things to do. They sound like quite simple, straightforward things to action, don't they?
I think so. And the other one, which is slightly harder to do, is I think the child's school should know at the earliest point, because we talk about adverse childhood experiences and early intervention strategies that each local government has. But if they don't know this child has gone through something like this within their family unit, and the child starts behaving differently, or I don't know, forgetting their timetable, because like in comprehensive school, they can, you know, if they're not wearing a tie or forget their timetable, they can be put in isolation or get detention or whatever. But if there's a lot going on at home, you know, a huge amount of change at home, confusion at home, you know, a child might not be told what's going on, the parents might want to protect them from it. School becomes their safe place. So they need to be able to go into school and have that empathy and that safe place be, you know, be the one consistency in their life. Because reintroducing stability in the home is very challenging through the investigation stage, because you don't know when it's going to end. So, yeah, I think education is vital. And also as well, when they grow as teenagers, you know, it might be that through school they could get counselling as teenagers if they're struggling with the knowledge of what their dad has done. So, yeah, I think education is key, but a little bit more complicated because of right to privacy. That's another one. So communication, education.
It's really helpful to, you know, just things that I personally haven't really spent too much time thinking about before speaking to you, you know, in terms of thinking about all the impact that's so much wider than just your husband and any victims that might be created in terms of the image thing, but you've really done justice to describing the impact on the family of people who commit these kind of offences really well.
Thank you. I think it's brilliant what you've said and what you've done, because the things that you've described, as Naomi said, seem to be rather simple, but actually we're a rather thoughtless bunch of person until somebody brings light into the room, which is what you're doing. And illustrates things. And then currently, of course, in our present state of regulation of everything, things have to be written down and the nice little tick box provided.
Yeah.
So the description you gave of the policewoman in the kitchen saying to you, well, if things were slightly different, then we could have done this for you, is a wonderful little vignette, I think.
Thank you. Yeah, I think when you say about writing things down as well, I think that's another thing that there's nowhere on the internet that you can go to find out what, you can't Google, you know, my ex-husband committed this crime and expectations on childcare, because everybody's quite reluctant to write it down at the moment because every case is different. And that makes me want to, you do have to peel me off the ceiling when I hear that, because I'm like, yes, every case is different and we do want to be judged on our each individual cases. However, if child sexual abuse, albeit online, becomes part of the equation, there are baselines, and those baselines is, until the police complete the investigation, any childcare professional will recommend supervised access only, because you have to mitigate against risk, and that's the best way of doing it. So you're breaking that family unit apart. And it's the same when, you know, after conviction, when they're on the sex offenders register, you know, a childcare professional will say, well, you know, to keep that child safe, you must be supervising access. But what that means to a family is that, you know, daddy lives next door but can't attend birthday parties, you know, can't take them on day trips like normal, can't take them on holiday. It's just huge. So be open about that. Write that down. Let it be stated, yes, every case is different and you can fight for more contact and dads move back in, because some dads have moved back in and mums can prove that they're keeping the child safe. But the majority of time, it's not. They are safe. But I mean, it's not easy to get the man back. It is lifelong. When my children have children, they'll have to think, how much interaction are we going to allow our children with granddad? So it's, yeah, that's why I think it's lifelong for them. It's because they're going to have children themselves one day.
So. There's a real courage, I think, in speaking as you are doing, because I think actually, you know, that shame that's associated with, you know, that sense of shame of being judged as the partner or former partner. And, you know, shame makes us want to hide and turn away, as you say. So, you know, really think there's a lot of courage and bravery in you to come forward, and really grateful to you for coming on here today and sharing your story, because I hopefully other people can benefit from that.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
Lovely to meet you.
And yourself.
Really enjoyed meeting with Lucy. Something very warm about her, and I suppose I was struck by this awful trauma in her life, and how I think the inclination would be to want to move away from it and not to have to keep thinking about it, and actually how she's really embraced trying to use something that created this huge impact in her life by trying to think about how she supports other people going forward. So not moving away from it, not avoiding it, but engaging with it and thinking about what lessons could be learned. And to me, that seems really admirable and something to be admired.
Yeah, I was thinking that what I really like about doing this particular work is that, well, there are several things. One, we meet a lot of very interesting and nice people, and that's a big bonus. But I think also what we've been able to do through our encounters is to shine a little bit of light, give a bit of a voice to people who have suffered some kind of hurt or injustice through no cause of their own, and who usually do go unseen and unnoticed. And I think, you know, Lucy's position is a prime example of this kind of situation, and Lucy, I think, is a tremendous advocate for the kind of situation that she's been in. And so it reminded me of several things. One was the ripple effect, which we used to talk about a lot in TC+, which is how people get caught up in things and hurt by them when they really have no kind of culpability, no guilt. It's another illustration of how there's no such thing as a victimless crime. And of course, we knew that about pornography anyway, but this is another aspect to it. And then the other thing that it made me think of was the issue of taint, how people become tainted by something, again through no fault of their own, and they find that their friends and acquaintances begin to regard them in a totally different manner, which must be extremely hurtful and painful. Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage lockeduplives.com and our Twitter account Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.